The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts, discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Welcome to The Daily Stoic, where each day we read a short passage designed to help you cultivate the strength, insight, wisdom necessary for living the good life. Each one of these passages is based on the 2,000-year-old philosophy that has guided some of history's greatest men and women. For more, you can visit us at dailystoic.com.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Hey, this is Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic podcast. I tell this story a little bit in the interview, but almost 10 years ago now, I flew to New York City for my first set of publisher meetings for what would be my first book. And I left those meetings. I went into those meetings as a marketing director, and I left those meetings an author. My first published book would come out, I think, 6 or 7 months later. And my guest today is the woman who helped make all that possible, Nikki Papadopoulos. She's the editorial director for Portfolio, an imprint at Penguin Random House, and she's been my editor on all my books, I think 10 or 11, who knows at this point, but I think I was the second book that she acquired there at Portfolio, Trust Me, I'm Lying. And then she bought the proposal for The Obstacle is the Way. She had the idea for Growth Hacker Marketing. And so Nikki and I kind of talk not just about that relationship, and we get into some personal stuff about collaborating and some of the conflict we've had even, but we talk about sort of the evolution of sort of stoicism in publishing, the writing process. And then we delve into sort of something I wanted to tease in this episode, which is my next book, which comes out on September 29th, Lives of the Stoics, The Art of Living from Zeno to Marcus Aurelius. I think it is the best, most complete sort of exploration of Stoicism as a philosophy for living. It's instead of focusing on what these philosophers said historically, I wanted to look at what they did, who they were as people, how they lived these words, as Epictetus said embody your philosophy. Don't just talk about it. And so with Nikki, we kind of talk about how that book came to be. And the reason I wanted to talk about that now is just to give you a little preview of the book, because the book is now available for pre-order. You can obviously pre-order it anywhere books are sold. Support your local indie retailer if you want, Amazon.com. But if you pre-order it, if you follow the instructions on our website, dailystoic.com/pre-order, you'll see we have a whole bunch of awesome bonuses, including 3 extra chapters that are not in the book. So you can check that out at dailystoic.com/pre-order. But Nikki is one of the best editors in publishing. She's worked on a dozen or more New York Times bestsellers, close to 24 Wall Street Journal bestsellers. She did The Four by Scott Galloway, Captivate by Vanessa Van Edwards, Thinking and Bets by Annie Duke, Hook by Nir Eyal, American Kingpin by Nick Bilton. Previously, she was an editor at McGraw-Hill, and she worked at Public Affairs Perseus, where she worked on one of my favorite books about the internet, The Net Delusion by Evgeny Morozov. She's a graduate of Brown University, which has a large replica of the Marcus Aurelius equestrian statue on it. She's got a daughter, and as we were finishing this interview, she was about to go on maternity leave to have her second kid, and she has a Cavalier King Charles named Ruby Roo. So check out my interview with Nikki Papadopoulos, get an inside peek into how I write, how my books have evolved, maybe some insight into how crazy and insane I am. And of course, don't forget to pre-order Lives of the Stoics at dailystoic.com/pre-order. So here we are. I actually don't know what book this is. Is this 10 or 11? I think it's 11.
You would know better than me. You actually had to write them.
Yeah, I sometimes lose track, which is weird, but then I guess I don't know if I should include the journal as a book or not. And then I'm always working on the next one, so it's hard to know if you include only published ones, but another one is officially done.
Another one. When did we start this?
Writing this book, or when did we start working together?
Working together.
Well, that's actually where I wanted to start too. I think it would have been October or November. I think it was November of 2011.
That sounds right to me.
I was curious. Maybe we should. What are your recollections of that meeting?
I think the first thing is that I don't know if you were actually wearing a hoodie, but you certainly gave the impression of someone who was wearing a hoodie.
Okay. What does that mean?
Well, you didn't show up in a suit, and I thought that was kind of cool. Like, you were showing up on your own terms, not on the terms of someone who was trying to make an impression on what they thought a big five publisher would be like. And actually at that time we were 6, because we were Penguin as part of Pearson. So we're now part of Random House.
Do a lot of people show up in suits at publisher
meetings?
Really.
No, right. Not really. But especially, I think you were like 23 at the time, and it was like a very Mark Zuckerberg kind of move.
I'm not sure about that. I think so. I was definitely older. I was definitely older than 23. I think I was 24, maybe 25. But I do. It is funny. It was like sometimes people will cut. Like, I remember I did this talk with Peter Thiel at the Reagan Library. This was like 2 years ago. This is for a conspiracy, and he showed up in a suit, and I was closer to a hoodie than a suit. And it was very uncomfortable. And then I realized I don't know if I actually have a suit, or I didn't at that time. So I feel like one of the reasons you become a writer is to not have to dress up. And then weirdly, you're in these scenarios where people are then appalled or surprised that you are not in the proper attire.
It was a good meeting. I mean, I remember being really impressed, although I was really prepared to be impressed. You know, I had reached out to your agent, Steve Hanselman, when I got to Portfolio, which was in October of 2011. And, you know, and just said, like, I'm here and I'm, you know, really interested in these kinds of books and I'd love to hear from you. And I hadn't really known him very well before that. So it was delightful when he sent me the proposal for your book. And I remember I was on a plane And I was reading it and I was like, this is not like anything I have ever read. It's sort of crackling and special and exciting and a little dangerous and feels very original. And so I remember having that feeling of like, oh, like maybe this could really, really work. And having the conversation with my boss, Adrian Zackheim. And so we were ready, like we were excited to meet you. We weren't like, who is this guy? So, and I think the story that opened the proposal was the story of you defacing a billboard somewhere in LA. And it was just so exciting and naughty. And so we were kind of ready to meet someone who was, you know, playing things on their own terms.
I do feel like most business books seem to start with, I was delivering a keynote address. And it's like, or some weird, you know, it's always this weird, really lame scene with the author doing something that's not very interesting.
It's either that, or I got to tell you, if I can just share the one thing that I never want to see ever, 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 ever on a business book proposal again, it's to quote an engagement survey, like an employee engagement survey, as justification for the need for the book. It's like, oh, like, you know, it, I would say like one out of every four. Like, did you know that, you know, X percentage of people say that they're not engaged at work? And yes, I'm aware at this stage. I'm very aware.
I have this weird memory, maybe because it's always like the thing that started a project, but I seem to remember like the moment. Intros of books have always been strange for me. Like, I never sit down and go, this is going to be the intro of the book. It's normally like, it just sort of hits me from somewhere, which I guess gets into this kind of Stephen Pressfield concept of the muses. But like, I remember, and we'll talk about Obstacle later, but I remember I was on a run in Manhattan along the East River, and I had the idea for the sort of scene of Marcus Aurelius writing Meditations. But I, trust me, I'm lying one. If my memory serves me correctly, I was eating at Quiznos down the street from the American Apparel Factory, and some version of that intro of the book hit me, and I jotted it down on a piece of paper, and that folded up this piece of paper and did not think about it or touch it for like a few years. And then obviously when I decided to write a book, it sort of, I unfolded that piece of paper and the intro was all there. So that's funny that that's what resonated with you.
Do you still have that piece of paper?
I may. I know I have all the note cards still of the books. I may have, the folded up piece of paper might not have worked as well for carrying it in the box, but I just found all the note cards for Trust Me, I'm Lying the other day in a closet upstairs at my house.
Wow. What was it like to look at them now with the benefit of almost 10 years of hindsight?
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, that whole book was strange. And it's funny that you were saying that it was sort of crackling. I mean, for people who don't know, almost all nonfiction books are sold with a proposal. And in that case, I basically sort of half quit my job, moved across the country and wrote like 2/3 or, you know, most of that book and then went out with it. I think there's a proposal too, but I certainly didn't know what I was doing. But I guess the benefit of it was that I didn't know that I didn't quite know what I was doing because, you know, I'd worked for Robert, so I had some vague understanding of the process, but I just sort of went out and did it. So there's kind of, I think when I look at the note cards, I'm both sort of impressed and appalled at the same time, if that makes sense. I also remember from that meeting, it was a week. So my grandfather had died, who I was very close to. And so I'd flown to Sacramento for the funeral. And then I took the red eye that night from Sacramento to New York. I'd crashed at an American Apparel. I landed at like 7 a.m. or 5 a.m., whatever the time difference was, and crashed at an American Apparel apartment for like 3 hours. And then I don't remember if your guys' meeting was first or what order they came in, but I remember just mostly running on sort of adrenaline and fumes. And then it all kind of got wrapped up very quickly because you guys preempted, for people who don't know, like you go to multiple publishers and then sometimes they bid against each other. Or if you feel like there's a connection, someone can preempt, and you guys preempted. So like I basically went to New York, not a writer. And then like a few hours later, I remember walking around, I guess, Soho, and it was like, oh, my life has totally changed, not just sort of financially, but as a writer.
Wow.
Like that's what I've become.
Wow.
And then I ordered an entire pizza at Lombardi's and I ate it all by myself.
That's kind of amazing. And
yeah,
happened since then. I mean, today it seems so natural to think about talking about a new book or, you know, talking about the next one. And it's funny to think back on that time.
It is. Yeah. It feels like a very long time ago. And I think what's weird, so when I wrote Trust Me, I'm Lying, because I'd sort of written about philosophy on my blog and stuff, and that was probably what, like, it was weird. I'd sort of kept the marketing side of my life, not a secret, but that wasn't what my sort of online audience was. And then I came out with this marketing book. And so a bunch of people were like surprised. And then they were like, I thought, you know, I think people anticipated maybe something more philosophical for me. And then the book was sort of controversial and weird. And then I the audience was very surprised when the sort of philosophy books started, which was itself sort of a radical departure. I'm curious, like, what do you, after Trust Me, I'm Lying, what do you remember? Because I remember the proposal came very quickly. I can't imagine you were expecting that as my follow-up book.
So you're when you say that, you mean Obstacle, the book that became The Obstacle is the Way, which I think that was the title that it came in with, but I can't remember.
No, I think the title was Turning Obstacles Upside Down. It wasn't quite right. The phrase. Yeah.
Yeah, it was Turn the Obstacle Upside Down. I do remember, and he might correct me on this, but I remember having a conversation with my publisher where we were sort of like, well, Ryan is going to write many more fantastic marketing books and we want to keep him. So I guess we'll do this side project for now, which was hilarious because, and you did write some very good marketing books, but I think that style of thinking is sort of, betrays a little bit of what's wrong with, you know, the publishing industry of always sort of looking in the rearview mirror. We'd had a success with Trust Me, which is in some ways a marketing book. And we were looking to the future and saying, okay, we're going to have more of this, and not really seeing the potential of this set of ideas in the same way. Now, I say not seeing the potential. We still knew that we really wanted to stick with you. And I credit, again, my boss, Adrian, because he's really good at sticking with writers for the long haul and saying, you know, I might not see, you know, it this far into the future, but I believe that this person believes that they can, and I'm willing to stick with them. And so, by the time Obstacle was written, I had a lot more of like, oh, I see what this is and I see what Ryan is doing and what his vision is. And I think this is going to work. But I remember having that initial conversation and being like, you know, let's do this. And then, you know, he'll come back to marketing, which is what he really should be doing. So,
because I did write another marketing book in between, right? It was weird. I'm trying to remember the order.
Right. It was Growth Hacker Marketing, which was kind of an experimental publishing thing. That started as like what used to be called a Kindle single, which was a very, very short ebook. And then that took off really, really well. And we ended up expanding it into a book. But yeah, I'm a little fuzzy on the timing between all of those things.
Because I remember, so I guess this sort of, it's funny to hear your guys' sort of vision, but what your guys' vision was at the time and mine, because if I remember the timing right, the proposal for Obstacle came like within a week or two of Trust Me, I'm Lying coming out. So obviously I've been working on it for a while. So I think my intention had always been, I want to get this marketing book out of the way and then write what I want to write about. And you guys were thinking about it the exact opposite order.
Well, it worked out.
Yes.
And I'm glad that it did, you know, and I think that's, you know, that's an argument to be made that, you know, when you find a writer that you trust, you really should trust them 100%, and you can advise them and you can give them feedback and you can share with them what you're seeing in the market or internally. But you really can't beat having a long-term investment with someone and their creative vision. And what I love about Portfolio, which is the imprint that I work at, is that we are really good about sticking with people for the long run. And I think something like a quarter or a third of our authors are 2, 3, 4, or 5 book repeaters. Nobody's quite at 10 books in 10 years. So I think you hold the record there, but it's unusual in nonfiction, especially to have that kind of long relationship. So that's something we're really proud of.
So, I mean, Seth Godin's had a pretty good run with you guys.
He did. He took a break.
To put it mildly.
He took a break. He published some books with us, and then he went and did this really interesting startup with Amazon called the Domino Project. And he did some books with them, and then he came back to us, and then he did some other side projects, and he's come back to us with a new book actually, which is coming out this fall as well, which I won't plug on your podcast if you don't have to. But it's very good.
No, I remember too, the decision was not without its risks. I mean, obviously you guys were willing to sort of take a book out of left field, but you know, there was this sort of criticism later on from people where it's like, oh, he's just sort of doing this to make money. And I remember I find that to be very funny because, you know, it certainly wasn't a financial step up to go at a business imprint to go, hey, I know I'm just coming off this, you know, book about, you know, this controversial marketing book. What do you say we try an obscure school of ancient philosophy next? Like you guys were not rude, but I don't think you weren't like ecstatic about it, if I remember.
Well, it wasn't. Again, you know, we didn't have a lot of data in the market as it existed that said there was a huge market for Stoic philosophy, which that's not the best way to make publishing decisions, but it certainly does influence how you think about things. And it's funny now because if you could see the number of proposals that come in that use the obstacle as the way as a comp, as a signal of the strength of the market and the appetite for books of popular philosophy in the sort of business self-improvement marketplace, I think it would really make you laugh. It's something that I've been watching with a lot of interest over the years. I'm just thinking, you know, what if we were so wrong about that, what else are we wrong about today?
Hey, it's Ryan. Got a quick message from one of our sponsors, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned.
There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80. That's 80 to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. It's always sensitive talking about these things, but Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance needed. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/TDS. That's hims.com/TDS for your personalized ED treatment options. Hard mints are a chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with your healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
Well, people have this weird impulse, which is, and I talk about this a little bit in Perennial Seller, but I think Peter Thiel talks about it best in Zero to One, which is like, people think that because someone is doing something that's proof of concept and you should copy it, when really you should think about how when they were the one to do it, no one was doing it. And so, like, I think people see that my books are about Stoicism, for instance, and they go, oh, Stoicism is a safe, you know, a safe niche or a lucrative niche or, you know, whatever. And it's like, it wasn't that when I started writing about it. And, you know, if you really read The Obstacle is the Way, I think that's the other thing people miss, is that only kind of retroactively did that book get sort of fully branded as being about Stoicism. Very deliberately, there's an asterisk or a, you know, a footnote in the introduction of the book that says, although I'm very interested in Stoicism, this will not be a book primarily about Stoicism, because people are not interested in those kinds of books, or something to that effect. And I wanted it to be sort of a book that's about the ideas inside Stoicism, but not beating anyone over the head with it. And so then, yeah, then people go, oh, I'm going to write, you know, this book about this subject or that subject, thinking that it's like, no, this was really a multi-book process of building an audience and building a sort of a style. And then people think that either they can just sort of tap into it, or that you can do that without laying the groundwork.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that's something that has always contributed quite a lot to your success, is you have a very authentic connection to your material. And, you know, I think people look at your, at the success of the books, and they think that it must be engineered in some way. You know, that maybe you look at a set of search terms and you know, work backwards to make Stoicism the thing. But the reason why the books are successful is because they originate with a very authentic connection between you and these ideas that you're willing to follow, no matter where it goes. And even if you're, you know, if you're sort of issuing caveats, like with Obstacles, like, well, it's kind of, you know, it's Stoicism, but this isn't a Stoic philosophy book. I think that, you know, your attraction to that set of ideas and your ability to explore it with authenticity and sincerity is what made that book work, and also set the stage for a lot of other people to discover and explore those same ideas.
I don't know why people struggle with that. It's a weird thing, because so with Obstacle, it's like, okay, I was really interested in and remain deeply fascinated by Stoic philosophy. I mean, like, you don't, I was running marketing at a publicly traded fashion company in my early 20s. Like, if to leave that for, you know, writing books about philosophy, that you have to actually like it. Otherwise you're basically committing like career suicide. And so you do have to really like it. But then I think this is the thing that people miss. You have to like what you're doing so much, whether it's like a book or a company you're starting, or, you know, some recipe for, you know, for some new kind of food or whatever. You have to love the thing so much. And then you have to get to this place where you go, I love this, but nobody else gives a shit. And in fact, not only do they not give a shit, they are under the impression that they are emphatically not interested in that style or type of, or thing or genre or whatever. And then you have to figure out how to translate your fascination and love into something that they would be interested in. And so like, I so loved the Stoics when I read them. And then I would read the books about Stoicism, and there were a few, and they were always like, you know, 1/10 of as interesting. And I found that was because they were just saying, you know, like Seneca said, or Marcus Aurelius said, or they were just like, it, you know, it's like the Bible is interesting. People writing about the Bible is not that interesting by definition. It's because it's derivative. And so what I wanted to do with Obstacle was find a way, like, what is the way into the ideas? And it turned out it was sort of illustrating the ideas and stories. But I don't know, I guess people are, if you're too self-involved about your love of a thing, you don't do the work that makes it interesting to people who are self-involved in their own things.
It's definitely a two-step process. You make a very good point. I mean, the first thing is the authentic connection. And then the next thing is to be a professional about turning that connection into something that other people can connect with. And you got to have both, really. I mean, you know, I think a little bit of what I'm reacting to is I think I see sometimes people trying to very coldly and rationally produce a book that they think will be commercial based sure. on what they see in the marketplace. And those books, they might be carefully constructed and researched, but they lack an emotional core. And I hate the word passion just as almost as much as you do, but I don't know if anyone hates it as much as you do, but you know, because they are manufactured, you know, readers are smart. They can pick up on that. And I don't think people respond well to that. On the flip side, once you have that authentic connection and passion, you really do have to work quite hard. And this is where the work of a writer comes in to turn that into something that other people can connect with, and you know, and to do it in a way that allows for another person's experience and point of view, which is really hard.
Yeah, I mean, I've always felt that the way to sort of thread that needle is you have to sort of step back and go, what is the thing that I wished existed earlier on, either in my journey or in my fandom or whatever? And so, like, you have to make the thing that you would want to exist, and you being a representative of hopefully a fairly large underserved audience.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which was tricky on. So if we talk about Lies, which is the new one, and it's actually an interesting sort of, there was the tricky part on Lives of the Stoics, which is obviously, I love Stoicism. Somewhat coincidentally, my agent, Steve Hanselman, and co-author on the book, also loves Stoicism. But I would say we it's not that we come at it from different perspectives, but we have very different backgrounds, right? So I'm a college dropout. Steve's a graduate of Harvard Divinity School. Steve can translate Greek and Latin. I can't even pronounce the words. And so I would say, like, sort of Steve's fascination with the Stoic figures, it's not that it's more academic, but it's much more sort of detailed oriented. And my fascination with the Stoics is much, I would say I'm much more interested in their essence or in the sort of moral example that they set. And so even as we sort of tried to break down this book, I mean, it could, for instance, very, one of the early iterations of it was like, do you split it up in chapters, or do you split it up in sort of mini biographies of each one of the figures? And if you're interested in how they all, you know, like if you're interested in the themes of Stoicism throughout history, then you kind of loop them in together and you have them overlap. If what you're really interested in is what does each one teach you, you end up sort of breaking it up like we did. So it was interesting on this book to have to like, to do what we were just talking about, but then also involve an additional party.
Yeah, tell me more about that, the process, because by the time I saw the manuscript, it was very, very baked. Like, you guys had really solved a lot of you know, what might have been earlier structural issues or issues of tone. And it felt very, very complete. Like, it, you know, I mean, we did have some discussions about, you know, whether to include certain details or not, or, you know, sort of like the normal editing conversation you have. But structurally, the book felt like it had been the, you know, the product of some very intense thinking.
I mean, I feel like that's one of the things I've learned now doing this 10 times is like, you have to, the more you do that hard thinking up front, the better the final product will be. Because if you're just sort of like going along and you haven't thought of all these different, you know, contingencies or issues or concerns, what happens is like you and I might get on the phone, you and being the editor, or, you know, you being a random friend or someone reading the book. And then someone goes, hey, have you thought about doing X? And X might sound perfectly reasonable in the context of that immediate conversation. And so you end up making this change or this change. And then you add enough of those together and you get this sort of weird amalgamation of like small short-term decisions, when really you needed to be like, what is this thing? What's the main goal? What is it accomplishing? Structurally, how is it set up? What's the vision for it? So then you kind of understand how all these little things fit into it. Like, you know, for instance, on this book, the decision to say like, this is about what the Stoics did, not what they wrote or what their theories were. Like that solved a lot of problems when we got to someone like Cicero being this sort of complicated figure of someone who was like a propagator of the Stoics, and he wrote a lot about what the Stoics wrote about, but then had trouble actually like what sort of could never fully commit. Sort of like, well, how do you end up portraying that person? If this book is just about Stoicism's evolution through history, you end up with, I think, a really boring chapter there where you're just like, and then Cicero said this, and then Cicero said this. But to make it, if it's like, no, this is a book about philosophy's sort of role in the real world, then you end up portraying Cicero as this sort of tragic figure who like knew what he should be doing, but could never quite bring himself to do it. So I think you have to, as a writer or as a leader or whatever you're doing, I really do feel like if you're not doing that hard thinking, then like, who is doing it?
That's a very good question. Yeah, I mean, it's critical. It's absolutely critical. And I think it really helps, as you say, it really helps people write the book. You know, you can write quite a lot of well-polished words without ever figuring out what they're for or what you're trying to do with them. Yeah. And I think that's probably like the biggest, you know, psychological hazard of your profession is not doing that problem solving before the writing process. Because writing I'm an editor, but writing is not magic. It's just a tool. It's a tool for achieving a certain outcome in the mind of your reader, and then by extension in the culture. And so if you don't know what you're trying to achieve, you can dance around without getting a lot done pretty easily. And which is, you know, frustrating to your reader, doesn't move your career ahead much. And, you know, it's definitely frustrating for your editor.
No, there's a great Seneca quote. He says, if you don't know what port you're sailing to, no wind is favorable. And and I think as a writer, the trickiest thing is like when I get notes back from you, or when I would get notes back from Steve or from Niels, the other editor I work with, is like, how do you like the notes are the notes, but and they're not right or wrong. They can, but they have to be evaluated in the context of what are you trying to accomplish, right? So it's like, I remember hearing Brian Koppelman was talking about in Rounders, people kept sort of criticizing that there was all this sort of like dialogue in the movie. And he's like, the whole point is that this is like a quotable dialogue driven movie. So like your note is taken and politely ignored, because that's literally like, you think you're criticizing the movie, but you're actually like confirming what we, that we did what we said. And so I think if you don't sort of strategically figure out what you're trying to accomplish as a writer, it's very hard to get feedback. And it's weirdly very easy to be led astray by seemingly well-intentioned feedback.
That's definitely true.
I'm curious. So do you edit a lot of, like the test of my stoicism was, of course, right. Like with Daily Stoic, which I also did with Steve, the delineation of roles was so much cleaner and clearer, right? It's like we pick the quotes together, Steve translates them, I sort of write the sections, and then Steve's sort of checking the work, so to speak. But I can't imagine that most multi, like I just read another book Portfolio did, the Unacceptable, about the college admissions scandal. And I noticed it was written by two reporters. And I just sort of like, I can't imagine writing a book with another writer often goes well.
Well, those two worked a lot, quite a bit. And I think had their relationship figured out before they sold this proposal, which is key. You know, I haven't done a ton of books where you have two equal co-authors. You know, there are definitely books where people have someone helping them, you know, whether it's on the structure or on the prose level. But, you know, I think it's very difficult as in any relationship, but especially in a creative relationship, to have two people who are doing the same thing. So you need to figure out like what your comparative advantage is, and then be honest with each other about what that is. And that can be easy for some people and very difficult for other people, I imagine. You know, I thankfully, and I'm very grateful to you and Steve for this, I did not, you guys presented a very united front. And if there was drama, but it was all away from my eyes. I got a beautiful manuscript on the day I was promised it, which is rarer than a unicorn, by the way. And I was very grateful for that.
Hey, it's Ryan. Got a quick message from one of our sponsors, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned. Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. I am so excited to tell you about my next book, Lives of the Stoics, The Art of Living from Zeno to Marcus Aurelius. If you're a fan of Stoicism and you want to know about the people behind the ideas that have been so influential in history, that have shaped this philosophy that's had such a big impact on your life and my life, well, that's what I wrote this book to do. It's sort of a follow-up sequel to The Daily Stoic. It's 26 biographies of the most fascinating Stoic figures in history: Marcus Aurelius, Zeno, Seneca, Cato, and so many others. And there's a whole bunch of bonuses if you pre-order. And we even have a limited edition run of signed copies, which you can get from Barnes & Noble. So for the pre-order information, go to dailystoic.com/pre-order. The book is out September 29th, but you got to pre-order it now. That helps me in a big way and gets you the bonuses. dailystoic.com/pre-order.
No, there really wasn't any drama. And I do try to, I don't think I've delivered any of my books late. It's a weird, like, I don't think I've delivered any of them late. Although it's sort of that thing where it's like, if you've never missed a flight, you've spent too much time at the airport. I don't know, maybe if I should have delivered some of the books late.
Well, you know, it's maddening because it takes away any psychological leverage I have over you.
Interesting. What would that do?
No, I mean, you know, I think as writers should be, they're very, you know, people worry about missing their deadlines. And I was just kidding. But I mean, we appreciate it. We do appreciate it. But I think there's also a little bit more understanding in the system than some writers, especially first time writers, give us credit for. You know, if you're writing a book for a major house, that has a long investment in you and your career and your talent, then, you know, we wouldn't be making that if we didn't believe in you and believe that you would be able to produce something special. And, you know, there are exceptions, of course. I mean, I think there's, you know, if the book is very news driven, and or if it's competing with another book that we know is coming, then the deadline gets very important. But if it's, you know, if it's the kind of book where you're putting in a ton of research and it really has to be a fantastic read, and, you know, I mean, I'm not going to like cut your legs off for being a week late.
No,
you can edit that part out, right?
Yes. No, it is weird though. And I think, you know, this sort of stoic virtue of sort of self-discipline, moderation being an important one. I do feel like a lot of writers or creative people struggle with deadlines. You know, they act like it's like, oh, you know, they act that it's sort of inspiration or that what they're doing is very hard, or, you know, you can't rush magic, whatever. And there's an element of that to it. But I do suspect that a lot of it is just sort of, it's very hard to manage oneself when you have a lot of freedom. And like, writing a book is crazy. I mean, if you think about my first book, it's like I was 24 years old. I'd never published a book before. You guys gave me like a couple $100,000 and you were like, please come back with a book soon. You know, like I do see where people sort of that's almost like the worst punishment you could inflict on someone, because like, no one is actually like making sure you show up for work every day and doing it. And a book is this really hard thing where you're working on it. The finished product, the finished manuscript you're talking about that sort of magically shows up on your desk is the result of a whole bunch of sort of average, mediocre work days added together. But you have only you, the person doing it, can accumulate those, and no one can sort of squeeze them out of you.
It's absolutely terrifying. And I think some people use the deadline as almost a way of ducking that gigantic, crushing fear that comes with the idea that like, this only works if I get it right and I'm here on my own and people can help me, but really it's my name in giant letters on the cover and nobody else's. And that, you know, like you said, I mean, it's almost a form of punishment. For some people, it's very motivating, and it's, you know, it provides a lot of avenues for, you know, for doing the work that they truly love. But as you said, you know, it can also be very lonely, I think.
Yeah. It's lonely, and I think the other hard part is like, you. Like I'm writing today on the next project that I'm doing, which we don't need to tell people about, but I was writing, and it's like, you know, what I did today, I did my workload, but I don't feel like great about it. Like I don't, like what I put down, I wasn't like, this is genius. This will obviously work. This will go untouched into the manuscript. You know, like it's just sort of like, ugh, or not ugh, that's too judgmental. It's more like, you know, meh, you know, like it is. And it exists, and you have to weirdly be able to manage the like, okay, I can, now that it exists, I can refine and shape it, but you first have to be able to get over that hump and deal with the discomfort of mediocrity almost.
So how do you deal with that?
I think you just do it every day.
Well, how do you, like, Ryan, deal with it?
No, that's what I'm saying. I think I don't really deal with it. I just do it every day. And like as I've been working on this one, I have to, especially having done this many books now, I have it weirdly, I remember most of my books as the finished product. And you kind of have to push that out of your mind and remember that all the books were sort of in that sort of pseudo raw, like that. You just have to get comfortable with the discomfort of it for extended periods of time. So I just remind myself, like, it's like pages add up to published work. So I show up every day and I work on it. And then I remember that, like, when I go for a run or a ride later this evening, probably two or three things will pop in my head that will plug in. Like, when I was driving across the country earlier last week, like, three or four things popped into my head that I inserted into earlier pages this morning after I finished doing my actual writing that kind of closed the loop or tightened them. It was like that. It was exactly that missing piece that tied that previously sort of half finished thing all together. So you just have to have the fortitude to be able to sit with that.
I think it's a lot for some people. And it's a muscle that you have to build up every day too. Like, it's not something that you can just switch on.
No, that's the job. Yeah, I feel like. And the hardest part too is like, okay, so I've been working on lives for, I don't know, a year and a half or 2 years or however long it's been. And I find the editors don't talk about this period enough, but it's the really hard one, which is like, okay, I did this book. It's now done. I felt pretty good about it when I finished. I felt pretty good about it when I read the audiobook. And then you go into this kind of, so it's, we're recording this, it's early August. No, it's mid-August. It won't come out. It comes out in the end of September, you know, and then obviously you don't want to, as a Stoic, you don't want to be validated by the external results, but you really don't. It's now just like sitting, this thing is just like sitting there and you don't know. It's like you sent in, speaking of college admissions, it's like you sent in your application, you did your absolute best, but you don't know for several months until the random letter comes in the mail that tells you whether you've been, you know, whether you've been accepted or rejected or not. So to me, the most existentially hard part is not the writing stuff, because day in and day out, like, I control the writing stuff. The really shitty part is between wrap and release. That's, to me, the most uncertain period.
So you said editors don't talk about that enough. What do you think that editors and publishers could be doing in this period to support their authors? I mean, for I'm like, you know, oh, books at the printer and being bound and distributed, like, I don't have to worry about it. but it's good, you know, it's good to point out that that it might be a time of quite a lot of anxiety.
Yeah, I mean, I do think talking about it that sort of, you know, sort of, if there was some name for this valley. Well, actually, in Julius Caesar, Shakespeare says, like, between the decision and the deed, what does he say? It's like a vague illusion or this weird phantasm. It's like when they decide to assassinate Caesar and then the morning they do it, it's like, that's the roughest period. And so I wish there was some name for that kind of like limbo-y period. But honestly, I mean, I think what writers should do and what publishers should push them to do, and my model with you guys is a little bit closer to, you know, enabling that. But I think what most people should do is start writing the next project, which is what I did. I mean, I started working on Ego before Obstacle came out, and I was already working on Daily Stoic when Ego came out. And I think having, just going back into that grind is actually like maybe the safest place to be.
That's interesting. I'm gonna steal that.
You should. I mean, I think I stole it from Stephen Pressfield, which is like, you know, you finish one manuscript and the next day you start the next one. That doesn't mean that there's not some pause and that you're not in sort of different stages on stuff, because you obviously do have to go back and work. But I really feel like, and for like when Obstacle came out, I mean, it did well. It didn't do poorly at all, but it certainly wasn't, you know, if we're just now here, you know, crossing the 1 million mark, you know, it probably sold 100,000 copies in the first 2 years, right? Something like that. So it certainly didn't come out of the gate. It didn't hit any bestseller lists, and it was not clear what it would become. But the fact that I already had my next book under contract and was working on it was a great place to be.
I would love to talk to you more about the content in live.
Okay.
Because I always have all these questions for authors that they're not problems to be solved. They're more just a curiosity. But I guess I would love to know about how your feelings towards these characters changed, if at all, in the process of writing. Because it's like, especially with biography, and the book did end up being a sort of series of mini biographies. You hear from writers that you get like these very intense sort of psychological relationships going with your subjects. And the book doesn't betray that in any way. Like it's not clear that any one person is, struck you more than others, but I would just love to hear more about, as you were writing, like, how were you thinking about these people and how did your thinking change?
It was weird. I mean, I think Marcus Aurelius I've had the longest relationship with, and that was the kind of most fascinating and weirdest one to write, because it was at the end of a fairly long process that I got to that one. So that one just kind of flowed out, and it was really sort of cathartic. Like, because I've read this person and interacted with them and been having this conversation with them for, going on like 15 years now. But I wasn't aware of all the details, right? I think that was the weirdest part with even Seneca and some of the other figures I kind of feel like I always intuitively understood their essence. And then you were kind of going and finding out these figures and scenes and moments that revealed the essence. Really going into Cato and his death, I found to be sort of haunting and sort of morally vexing. Seneca, obviously, to me, is this sort of figure for our time. This sort of deeply ambitious, deeply talented, wise person who ends up, serving in Nero's administration. And it was a moving, weird experience to be sort of biographizing these people after having spent so much time with them. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting about Seneca. He's definitely a very complex character, and you can see that not much has changed between then and now in some ways.
I was just reading this James Rahm piece he wrote in The New Yorker, and he was like, Seneca could have been the anonymous writer of that Trump tell-all, or the person who wrote that op-ed in The New York Times. Like, that was what Seneca thought he was doing. Whether you support Trump or not, that's what Seneca thought he was doing. He thought he was the sort of adult in the room. And then it really quickly becomes a complicated discussion about whether you're the adult in the room or whether you're complicit with the bad things that people in the room are doing. And I think Seneca kind of embodies that.
Yeah, fascinating.
And then I think at the core of all the figures is this sort of courage, especially the courage of the sort of Roman Stoics. So if you go from like sort of Cato through, Cato through, let's say, Musonius Rufus, there's just this kind of incredible courage where they're sort of constantly challenging the powers that be, that they're on the razor's edge of losing everything at all times. I mean, Musonius Rufus is exiled 4 times. Thrasea and Helvidius and Agrippinus all lose their lives, sort of challenging Nero. I think that the weird part too was there was a sadness there for me that now there are senators who the consequence of being courageous is that you don't get reelected 4 years from now, potentially, and then you go make a ton of money as a lobbyist or a lawyer or a Fox News correspondent and still don't want to do it because somebody might tweet something meanly at them.
Yeah, it really puts some people's behavior in perspective. That's all I'll say about that.
Yes. Well, I do know Portfolio works with some of these figures with these Sentinel imprints, so we won't go too much into it.
Thank you.
I had one last question, and this might be sort of crazy or inappropriate, but I thought it'd be interesting to talk about. Sometimes you don't get opportunities to do this, but I'm curious. So we started it in 2011. I was like a kid. Had you done any other books at Portfolio, or was I the first author that you signed?
It was the second book I signed, but the first one that I signed that came out.
Got it.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And so it's been, almost 10 years now. We've done at least 10 books, and then we've collaborated in some other projects. I don't know. I feel like there's more sort of tension and conflict in our relationship than I would like. What do you think? Where do you think we've gone astray is a strong word. What do you think is at the root of that, and how do we collaborate better?
I think it's true of everybody who has my job that you're stuck with a lot of masters to please. You know, I work as an editor because I love books and I love working with authors, but I don't work for you. You know, I work for Penguin Random House and I represent the interests of my company as I should, as they pay me to. And, you know, sometimes I think there is, tension or conflict over what, you know, you want to do or something you want to try that, you know, as the representative of my organization, I can't advocate for it as effectively as I would if, you know, if I were like on your team or as your agent. But, you know, I think that kind of tension is probably present in lots of business relationships that are around a creative product. You know, I've never worked in Hollywood, but I've read about it. And it seems like there's a lot of the same kind of thing, you know, where you're balancing, you know, your responsibility to your authors and their work, and your responsibility is really to the work first, and also your responsibilities to whoever is funding that work and distributing it. So that's what I would say, sort of off the cuff.
It's weird too, because I think most, like, even the other authors that you have that you've worked with for a long time, they don't have as many touch points, right? Like, I think the tricky part about doing 10 books in 10 years or whatever is that there's an exponential amount that creates an exponential amount of things that can go wrong or that need to be managed. And so I think I don't know how to get away from it, but it does feel like, I feel like most of our sort of disputes or arguments or conflict is never about editorial matters. It's about administrative matters or financial details, or like, you know what I mean? We end up, it's like people who are married who also work together. You're arguing over, like, you know, right, expense reports or something and the dishes at the same time. So it's like, I think that's been a tricky part of it. And just the duration of it, like, you know, normally, you know, authors tend to bounce around or whatever. So or the editor leaves and then you go to a new house or whatever. And so I think that's a wrinkle in it that we haven't quite figured out how to manage.
Yeah. I mean, it is definitely true that there are, I mean, hilariously, like, because you are successful, we have more ISBNs assigned to you and, you know, more titles and more editions and more reprints. And each one of those has, you know, a 0.01% chance of having some kind of screw up on it. Just because, like, you know, publishing is made up of humans. But if you had only ever published one book with, you know, in one edition,
right,
you might not have had to experience like the full range of everything that can go wrong. So, you know, I wonder sometimes I wonder if like I should set you up with like, you know, one of the commercial fiction authors who's, you know, also writing like one or two books a year and who's really had like a long experience. I'm like, oh, I think that actually is probably more your experience than like a typical nonfiction author, because, you know, every edition has its wrinkles, right? Whether it's like right. hardcover, the ebook, the audiobook, paperback, if we end up doing a paperback, we did a box set of three of your books. And, you know, you'd think that like that wouldn't take as much conversation and work as it did, but it did. You know, like it's an ISBN, it has to be managed, it has to be designed, we have to try and keep it in stock. You know, so it's yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely, it's important to preserve that purity, I think, of the conversation about the creative, you know, about the title, about the cover, about the manuscript, and to try to keep the administrative stuff, you know, on a sideline. But it is hard because, you know, and I am keenly aware of this, like, you know, this is a direct, like all of the things that happen on your books have a really direct effect on you and your life and your family, and in a major way. And like, that fact does not escape me.
We do in that sense, we kind of exist in different universes. I remember when we had that issue with the pirated copies or something, and we won't get into the details, but you said something like, you know, so-and-so doesn't care about the little guy. And you were referring to their relationship with Penguin Random House. And I was like, Penguin Random House is not the little guy. Penguin Random House is a multi-billion dollar company. I'm the little guy. Right. And so it's like you have a job and the things affect me differently than they affect the, like you have a job and there's a bureaucracy as part of the job and, you know, expectations and relationships. And I exist over here in this kind of fantasy world of just me answering only to myself and whatever I wrote. And so, yeah, I feel like that we have to do a better job of keeping church and state separate too, in the sense of the editorial sort of content relationship and then the like business administrative execution side of the relationship, where it seems like the majority of the tension ends up actually being.
Well, let me flip the question on you since we're doing a sort of soul to soul moment.
Okay.
Like, you know, you are a man of many options. And yet you've stuck by us. You know, can I assume that the value we provide is greater than the sum of our reprint mishaps?
in some respects, yes, of course. No, and certainly certainly the equation was very different 10 years ago. And it's a weird situation too, where the calculations made 10 years ago are precise, and the collaboration and the sum of the parts are are what have contributed to the increase in options, you know, now. So that's like a weird thing to consider. But I love working with Portfolio. I love the reach of it, of course. But it, you know, doing this leather-bound edition of Daily Stoic has been an interesting experience too. It's been a lot of work, and it's like, you know, getting things shipped by boat from Europe has been a nightmare, and gave me a little bit of insight into what you guys are dealing with every day. But it's also looking at the sort of retail environment. It's the pandemic has been interesting, because it's like Amazon was dominant before, and now it's like, who's even going inside bookstores? Who can go inside bookstores? So it's been weird to think about where the future of the business is going.
I'd be lying if I said that didn't keep me up at night, but you know, it's an interesting point that you make. I think that I've talked to many authors who, you know, either prefer self-publishing or have tried self-publishing and have decided that that's not how they want to spend their time. And and I have total respect for both ways of looking at it, right? I mean, like, if you are the kind of person who, you know, if you're doing a project where it's more important to you than anything else to have total control over the creative, over the cover, over the timing, over everything, then yeah, you probably don't want to partner up with a giant corporation. Like, that's, you know, if you were a business, like, you probably wouldn't want to take a huge loan from JP Morgan either, you know, like, that's
right.
And so you know, thinking about it in terms of, like, sort of combining the business decision with the creative decision, and like, is this partnership going to be something that adds value to my project, or is it going to, you know, am I sort of signing up for this kind of wish fulfillment of like, oh, I'll, you know, I'll take this investment and then everything will work out. I think that's really important for writers to think about. And a lot of people, I mean, I'm happy to say, I do think we add a lot of value because people do come back to us. And, you know, maybe it's because we handle a lot of those pain in the ass details, like, you know, the slow boat from Belarus or wherever, you know, and in a way that is efficient for them. But, you know, I'm hopeful that also, you know, we add some kind of value on the creative and on the editorial as well. The thing about doing it yourself is that you can do anything you want, which is both great and also not great. You know, and you've written a lot before about the value of having someone push back on you when you don't want to be pushed back on creatively. And I do think that there's something to that. I mean, here I'm just sort of talking general terms, but.
No, I think those constraints are helpful creatively. I just think it'll be interesting for publishers going forward, you know, as the distribution side of things becomes much and much less important. And, you know, it's sort of like, yeah, we put your book up on Amazon for you or whatever, or, you know, we put it on Audible for you. Like this last one, I recorded the audio book for Lies of the Stoic. I recorded, you know, Lies of the Stoics in my, you know, the annex to my office, you know, and so it becomes the sort of technical side of it becomes less important, I think, and it will have to be, does the publisher help a person realize something that they would have trouble realizing on their own? Or does the publisher help get creatively more out of the author than they might be able to get on their own, in addition to handling, you know, pesky details? I think that's going to be important because, yeah, we used to have lots of big marketing discussions about how many, you know, copies this account was ordering or that account. And it's not that that doesn't exist anymore, but it is a smaller percentage of the pie. I mean, we're not even talking about airport distribution and Lives of the Stoics because who's spending time in airports, right? And so it's a weird change that everyone has to adapt to, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, hopefully this is temporary.
The Antonine Plague lasted for 15 years, Nikki. So,
thank you. I'll keep that in mind.
No. I think it makes sense. Well, here's to many more books, and we can tease to people that we are already set to be in business together for several more books, and so. All the discussion we're having is moot anyway because we're hitched for a few more, and people can stay tuned for those.
Awesome. Well, Ryan, I'm so pleased for you and excited about this one that's coming out in September. It's called Lives of the Stoics. If your readers don't know about that yet, and you know, I think it's going to be really, cool. We've got a lot of fun stuff planned.
Well, thank you. And yeah, thanks for taking the meeting 10 years ago. And more importantly, thanks for I guess, reluctantly purchasing the obstacle is the way. So I would get it out of my system and write other marketing books. And because without that, we wouldn't be here right now.
Indeed.
Amazing. All right. Thanks.
If you're liking this podcast, we would love for you to subscribe. Please leave us a review on iTunes or any of your favorite podcast listening apps. It really helps. And tell a friend. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shay Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shay Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture-themed trophies for six basketball-related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill, you might win some, but you just lost one trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.